This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. The very latest polls suggest the race for control of the Senate now involves states that most would have considered out of reach for the Democrats. About a half dozen races in key battlegrounds will likely determine whether Republicans keep or lose their majority. Earlier this week, we focused on contests in Arizona, Montana, Iowa, and South Carolina. You can find that show on our website, the1a.org. Today, we move to the next big three: North Carolina, Georgia, and Maine. Now, starting us off in North Carolina is Jeff Tiberi. He's Capitol Bureau Chief at North Carolina Public Radio and host of WUNC's Politics Podcast. Jeff, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Also with us for the whole show today is Jessica Taylor. She's the Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report. Jessica, it's great to have you back.
Thank you.
So, Jeff, the Supreme Court just ruled that North Carolina will be allowed to extend its deadline for receiving mail-in ballots. For people who might have missed this story, get us up to speed.
Yeah, so effectively where we stand and where things are going to hold through the election is that any ballot postmarked on or before November 3rd can be counted through November 12th. State legislators had made a deadline earlier this year when they had convened, and then due to some of the litigation that was filed and challenging some of the various election provisions here in North Carolina, the State Board of Elections and the Attorney General on a separate path had reached an agreement to accept ballots because there was concern about them getting in only 3 or 4 days after Election Day, accepting them up until November 12th. Now, Republican state lawmakers sued. They brought this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. They said that the State Board of Elections and the Attorney General had usurped the constitutional authority of the state legislature. But ultimately, in an 8-justice ruling, a 5-3 ruling that dropped last night, this November 12th deadline will ultimately stand.
How surprising is this ruling, especially considering the court decided this week that the opposite was true in Wisconsin?
I don't know. What's surprising anymore, right? It's a really good question. I wasn't totally surprised. I didn't know what to expect, candidly. But I do think, I mean, unsurprisingly, the Republicans are upset with this ruling, or a lot of the ones we've heard from this morning. But voting rights activists say that in this year, with all of the variables at play, this is the best pathway to having the most accurate count here in North Carolina.
Well, we'll have to parse out exactly the difference in those rulings on another show. Right now, I want you to lay out North Carolina's Senate race for us. Who are the candidates?
Sure. So the Republican incumbent is Tom Tillis. He was elected in 2014. He ousted a Democratic incumbent, Kay Hagan. The Democratic challenger is Cal Cunningham. He was a one-term state lawmaker almost 20 years ago, ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate in 2010 in a contest against Richard Burr. Now, Democrats and Republicans do agree on this. For the last year or so, they have circled North Carolina as one of the most vulnerable seats for the Republicans, one of the best opportunities for a pickup for a Democrat. So a lot of the people that I've talked to constantly here in the last 10 months or so, they view Arizona and Colorado and Maine as kind of the ripest three to flip. And then comes North Carolina, and that's significant because if you do the math, if Democrats are to add those three and they are expected to lose that Senate seat in Alabama, North Carolina becomes potentially the 50th or the 51st seat. So the winner here could signal power in the next U.S. Senate.
Well, let's hear from the front-running candidates in North Carolina themselves.
Rental houses in Louisiana, trailer parks in Florida and Tennessee. We moved 7 times before I was 16, living paycheck to paycheck. I grew up with strong parents and humble people in humble places, and I take a little humility to the U.S. Senate, where it's in short supply. I'm Tom Tillis. My job is fighting for your job.
I'm Cal Cunningham, and growing up in a place like Lexington taught me a lot about hard work, service, standing up for your neighbors. It's one reason I volunteered after 9/11, served 3 tours, and took on corrupt government contractors.
So Jeff, compared to some of the other Senate races we'll be talking about, North Carolina is quite traditional. Candidates talking about their humble beginnings. But what's gotten complicated about this race?
There's a lot that's gotten complicated, right? So in early October, right at the same time, we as a nation were learning that the president had tested positive for COVID-19. We learned that Tom Tillis, who is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, had been at that that press conference, that event announcing and celebrating Amy Coney Barrett as President Trump's pick. He was there. He contracted the virus. So we learned that on, I believe it was that Friday evening, October 2nd. And then hours later, Cunningham, in a statement, acknowledged that he had been having a correspondent sexually suggestive text messages with a woman who is not his wife. So what had already been a very expensive and very competitive U.S. Senate race got a little more salacious here about a month ago.
And we got this voicemail from Kimberly. She's a voter in North Carolina.
For me, it was still a very clear decision with regard to the distinctions between Cal Cunningham and Tom Tillis. I feel as though Tom Tillis really has done our state a huge disservice and quite honestly has been pretty in lockstep with the Republican Party on some things that hurt North Carolinians. Cal Cunningham has shown poor judgment. I still voted for him. I held my nose and I did it, and I hope for the best for my state.
Kimberly, thanks for leaving us that voicemail. We also got this email from Richard who says, I am very aware of Cal Cunningham's extramarital affairs and his poor decision-making. No politician is a righteous soul. At least Cunningham admits his mistakes while Donald Trump continues to lie about paying off prostitutes. Jessica, does it surprise you that Cunningham's extramarital scandal hasn't really hurt him in the polls?
Well, I think the question is, have we as a society sort of become numb to these things? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Democrats, they point back to, well, Donald Trump is in the White House and he has been accused of, you know, sexual misconduct and had admitted to affairs before. So I think that, is that one voter said, that's sort of what we are hearing, is that they're voting more for the policy than the person. And Cunningham was, I mean, his name ID never got very high. This was really sort of more always about voting Tom Tillis out. And while I think that, I mean, Republican outside groups and Tillis's campaign have put millions of dollars into ads hammering him over this, saying, you know, you can't trust his character. This is sort of a vote about decency and different things. And if he, you know, lied to his family and his wife, what would he do to you? And I think that's driven up Cunningham's negatives. But I, you know, this is still a very close race, though. But I still, it's not one that Republicans, despite this big gift that they have been given, feel very good, feel confident about, I would say, heading into Election Day.
Well, Jamie writes on Facebook, voted straight Democratic ticket in North Carolina because we desperately need Medicaid expansion and we need to send a message to the Republicans who have our state in a stranglehold. Go home. Jeff, how close is this race at this point?
You know, Cunningham has held a lead in almost every poll that we've seen for 6 months. The advantage has gotten a little more narrow since the sexting scandal hit, and a number of these polls are within the margin of error. He's still seen as the leader here, but you know, this we're expecting this to be pretty close once everything is counted here in early November.
And what are the key issues North Carolinians are paying attention to in this race?
You know, I think that similar to what we've seen at the national or from the presidential candidates, we've heard a lot about law and order from the Republican side, and we've seen a frequent pivot from Democratic candidates, really writ large here in North Carolina, particularly Cunningham, pivoting back to the Affordable Care Act, noting that Tom Tillis has voted several times to try to do away with that. So health care has been something that that Democrats, as well as response to the pandemic, those have been really the two issues that Democrats have frequently turned to.
That's Jeff Tiberi, Capital Bureau Chief at North Carolina Public Radio and host of WUNC's Politics Podcast. Jeff, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll continue our roundup of key Senate races with Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report. Up next, Georgia. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
On the next episode of Louder Than a Riot, how a law meant to control the mob changed the mixtape game forever.
Gangsta Grillz is the biggest thing arguably ever in the mixtape's history. Don't tell me that what we're doing is wrong.
Listen now to Louder Than a Riot, the podcast from NPR Music.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing some of this year's key Senate races with Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report. Let's turn now to Georgia, where two Senate seats are up for grabs. Greg Bluestein is a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Georgia's Senate race is pretty unusual this year. What's the situation and who are the candidates?
Well, it's unusual because we have two of them. Mm-hmm. We've got a traditional race for a six-year term between Republican Senator David Perdue, running for a second term against John Ossoff, his 33-year-old challenger, who is in that's more conventional race. There's sharp contrast between their backgrounds and experiences and platforms. But the wild, chaotic race is the second race, and that's for Senator Kelly Loeffler's seat. She was appointed to the seat earlier this year by Governor Brian Kemp. It was a vacant seat held by retiring Senator Johnny Isaacson, and that is a 20-candidate free-for-all. All the candidates are on the same ballot. A Democrat, Raphael Warnock, a first-time candidate, has emerged as the front-runner. He's about 30 to 40% in the polls. But there is basically a Republican primary going on as well between Kelly Loeffler and Congressman Doug Collins, who are racing to the party's right to try to grab conservative voters. And there's an expected runoff in that race in January where, you know, who knows, but control of the Senate could hang in the balance.
Well, Jessica, how significant is it that two seats in the Senate are at play in Georgia? What are the national implications of this?
I mean, they're huge. This is two races, and we have both of them in our toss-up column. And as Greg explained, there's a lot of different dynamics there at play. And then simply the fact that, you know, Republicans and Democrats that I talk to, they think that not just the special election, which we've long expected to go to that runoff on January 5th, 2021, but that the regular election could do that as well, because Georgia has a law where if you don't get 50%, even in the regular race, then you have to go to a runoff, which has happened in 1992 and in 2008. So, you know, I still think when we look at it that we could know the Senate majority before this, but if these are two seats that are determining whether Republicans and Democrats are – whether Democrats, rather, are in the majority, I mean, it's all holes barred. Everyone, you know, goes down to Georgia. Or does this determine how big of a majority Democrats may have? I still think it's probably the latter. And then there's so many factors to think – you know, Democrats are certainly banking on very high election day turnout, which we've already seen there with lines at the polls and just, you know, incredible amounts of ballots being returned already. But then what is the political environment post-election? If Biden wins, are Democrats still enthused? If Trump loses, do his voters still come out? So there's just still a lot that we don't know about what the political climate will be in those 2 months as well.
Well, let's hone in on the race between Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler and Republican Representative Doug Collins and their Democratic contender, Raphael Warnock. Let's listen to the candidates for this seat.
Look, I think voters don't vote for politicians. They vote for themselves. And so what you have to do is help them to see themselves and their issues in the message. And so I think the onus is on me as a candidate to help people to see the ways in which I'm intending to stand up for them.
I'm a lifelong conservative, pro-Second Amendment, pro-Trump, pro-military, and pro-wall.
The real issue here is not a matter of who's conservative. I'm that person, and we've been proving the other is not. But the other issue is who's actually worked for Georgia. Things like criminal justice reform, things like mental health issues.
So those were the top contenders for that seat, Democratic candidate Raphael Warnock, Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, and Republican Representative Doug Collins, respectively. As some of you wrote to us from Georgia, Kevin emails, I moved to Georgia from Maryland 2 years ago for a job. It was a good move for me. I added my voice to the thousands of progressive people who are voting and changing the state from red to blue. David writes on Facebook, it's not even going to be close, Trump 2020. And someone else shared on Twitter, definitely voting straight Democrat in Georgia. Perdue and Loeffler have to go, dropping off my ballot now. Jessica, how big of a deal would it be for Georgia to vote in a Democratic senator? When was the last time that happened?
I mean, it was when Max Cleland was the last Democratic senator, and Zell Miller, really. So it's we've seen Georgia that is certainly changing. I mean, we saw, you know, it was a Democratic stronghold and sort of right after the Civil Rights era and since sort of the 90s. And then we saw it rapidly change and it's been very Republican. But, you know, as some of those callers were pointing out, that people are moving in from out of places. I mean, the Atlanta suburbs, the growth there is just explosive. And, you know, two counties that I'm watching especially are Cobb County and Gwinnett County, and these have been some of the fastest growing areas. And these are counties that went heavily for Mitt Romney in 2012, but then flipped to back Clinton in 2016. And we've seen, again, the story of the suburbs was 2018, how Democrats flipped back the House. And in fact, they flipped a seat there in the Georgia suburbs. And I think they're poised to flip another House seat as well. And then these two Senate races, I mean, really, we were watching them certainly because of the changing demographics and things in the state, but I don't think I expected one, let alone both of these races to be competitive. The regular election, we actually moved into toss-up in July, and I think that that's one that's just become very, very close, and you've seen David Perdue, I think, look very scared on many instances. And then the special election is really interesting to me because you have Kelly Loeffler that was appointed to try to sort of stave off this bleeding that Republicans were seeing in the suburbs, especially with women. So she's a businesswoman from Buckhead, from the Atlanta suburbs. But because Collins got in, she had to go so far to the right to sort of prove her conservative bona fides that she's virtually unrecognizable from the type of politician and senator that Governor Brian Kemp had intended to appoint, I think.
Well, Greg, you mentioned that Senator Loeffler and Representative Collins were racing to the right. How are they distinguishing themselves from one another in this race?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to watch because Doug Collins is a four-term congressman who had already established himself as a very conservative lawmaker. He was a former member of the Georgia legislature as well. He was President Trump's top defender on the House Judiciary Committee, or at least one of his top defenders. Kelly Loeffler was unknown. I mean, when I say she was not in the political spotlight at all, I mean it. I mean, she just was not, I think I mentioned her as a possibility to fill that vacant seat, Senator Isaacson's seat, only because I happened to see her that day in that first article where Senator Isaacson announced he was going to retire. But otherwise, I mean, she was kind of just not on the radar. So she had no real record. And from the moment she got in, she was appointed, she announced that she was going to be pro-Trump, pro-guns, and pro-life. And so she has tried to give Doug Collins no room to outflank her on the right, even running ads saying that she's more conservative than Attila the Hun. And Doug Collins has been painting her as this phony, as this bandwagon Republican, as inauthentic, as a faux conservative. And she's hit right back at him, calling him a career politician and modeling herself in the same way as Governor Kemp, who appointed her, modeled himself as an outsider who is going to bring change to politics. So it's been really fun watching them kind of go at each other and try to race to the right. Meanwhile, Reverend Warnock, the Democratic frontrunner, has pretty much been unscathed by them because they've been so focused on attacking each other. He's been allowed to kind of climb in the polls without any real hit.
And how have the shifting demographics in Georgia impacted, particularly this race?
Oh, huge. There's one million more voters in the rolls than the last presidential election. We're seeing numbers showing that we have an enormous amount of early votes already, more than 3.5 million early votes, either mail or in person early. And about a quarter of them did not vote in the 2016 election. So a lot of newer voters, it seems like the electorate's going to be more diverse and younger. And remember, Georgia has been a solidly Republican state for a long time, and a state where no Democrat has won statewide in a dozen years. But 2018, it was very, very narrow, where Stacey Abrams lost to Republican Brian Kemp by only 55,000 votes.
Okay, let's turn to the battle for the other Senate seat in Georgia. Democratic candidate John Ossoff and Republican Senator David Perdue faced off in a debate earlier this month.
Let me just bracket what we're going to hear tonight just a minute. First of all, John Ossoff is desperate. He will say anything to hide his radical socialist agenda. He wants to defund the police. He wants open borders, sanctuary cities. He will say anything to hide his radical socialist agenda. That's not only dangerous.
10 seconds.
It's dangerous for communities and families in Georgia.
All right. Thank you very much. Emma, please ask a question to John.
I think I get a rebuttal here, do I not?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Well, we can see you're reading from your notes that your staff has prepared you. And the question was about this COVID-19 pandemic, which has killed nearly 220,000 Americans. After you assured us the risk to our health was low and compared it to the common flu.
So we're seeing spikes in coronavirus cases across the country, but Georgia is a state that's continuously struggled to keep cases down. What role is that playing in the race and how Georgians may vote, Greg?
Huge. It's a major role. Poll after poll after poll shows that the pandemic, healthcare, and economy are the three top issues that are driving voters' votes. They're driving voters' decisions. And when we ask voters who they prefer, who they see is doing a better job handling the pandemic crisis, it is Joe Biden by a solid margin. But when we ask them the same question about who could better handle the economy, it's President Trump. So I think that mirrors what we're seeing in a lot of national polls. And clearly the candidates have very different strategies with approaching this. You heard John Ossoff essentially claim that Republicans are downplaying the coronavirus pandemic and kind of writing it off, and Republicans saying, what would you have us do, shut down the economy again, that the cure can't be the worse than the disease.
That's Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also here with Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report. She's sticking around as we head to Maine to talk about the Senate race there. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Land I Trust, a podcast from the Sierra Club featuring people sharing their experiences with climate and justice issues. This season brings unique stories of energy transition and community transformation amidst the growing movement for environmental, racial, and climate justice. Listen to season 4 of The Land I Trust on sc.org/stories, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In this election, most of the country already has their mind made up. Whether President Trump or Joe Biden wins this November will be decided by a small group of undecided voters. Find out what could get them off the fence every day on the NPR Politics Podcast.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. Let's get back to our roundup of key Senate races with Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report. We're heading to Maine now, and we're joined by Kevin Miller. He's a staff writer covering Maine state politics for the Portland Press-Herald. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us a bit about the candidates in Maine's Senate race.
Well, we have four candidates on the ballot, but the two real contenders are the incumbent Republican Senator Susan Collins and Democrat Sarah Gideon. Susan Collins is, one of the best known and had been one of the most well-liked politicians in Maine. She's a 24-year Senate veteran who's really cultivated this reputation as a moderate kind of deal maker that's willing to work with both parties. She's been reelected with Democratic and independent support over the years, and I think she won by about 68% during her last reelection. But everything changed in 2016 when Donald Trump won, and with the Republican control of the Senate. And then on the other side, you have Sarah Gideon, who's a 48-year-old mother of three. She's kind of risen through the ranks of Democratic politics in the state pretty rapidly over the past decade. She now serves as Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives. And she's a progressive, but she's not quite as liberal as Republicans are making her out to be.
Well, Maine is a state with ranked choice voting. What is that, and how might it affect the outcome of this race?
Yeah, so ranked choice voting is a process where voters can actually, rank their candidates in order of preference. So they can say, my first choice is candidate X, my second choice is candidate Y, and down the list. This comes into play when you have more than two candidates on the ballot. In this case, we have four candidates. We have Senator Collins, Sarah Gideon, and we have two independents in the race, Lisa Savage and Max Lynn. So this comes into play only when no one candidate gets more than 50% of the vote. And when you get into that situation, that's when the ranking process comes into play. And so what happens is the the computer algorithms will go through and they'll eliminate the last place candidate, and they will give whoever their voters chose as their second choice, that second choice will go to the remaining candidates. And this kind of process continues from the bottom up until one candidate finally gets 50% of the vote.
Well, let's hear from the candidates. This is Democratic candidate Sarah Gideon and Republican Senator Susan Collins on the debate stage last month.
So I want to ask Senator Collins who she thinks should be leading this country. She has neglected to answer that question, and I'd like to give her the opportunity tonight. I think Joe Biden should be our leader to help us through with public health and rebuilding an economy.
I don't think that the people of Maine need my advice on whom to support for president.
It's not that Mainers are looking for advice about who to vote for. It's that they want to know who their senator thinks should be leading us.
Explain a little bit more about what Senator Collins is up against this year, Kevin. Talk about the position she's in with Democrats and Republicans and the line she's trying to walk.
Yeah, she's definitely in a precarious position, and you can tell from that dialogue between Sarah Gideon and Senator Collins. So Senator Collins is a moderate Republican. She's one of the few moderate Republicans left in the Senate. The Democrats are saying she's really not as moderate as she makes herself out to be. And they say that she's voting too often with Donald Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And they say this is really not in keeping with Maine's more moderate, voting base. So what you're hearing there in that dialogue between the two candidates was, Senator Collins has yet to say whether she's supporting President Trump's reelection. She voted in 2016. She was very public about the fact that she was not going to support the president. But this time around, she's refused to say. And the Sarah Gideon and the Democrats have really seized on that. That refusal to say where she stands on the president look, she's not reliable. She won't be honest with us.
Anne writes, sorry, Susan, you lose the seat because your vote now means absolutely nothing. You could have stopped Kavanaugh and chose not to. The vote sealed your fate. This vote means nothing. Michelle writes on Facebook, Collins is pandering by voting against Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation. She's worried because her vote for Kavanaugh made a lot of people angry, and she knew her abstention wouldn't hinder Barrett's confirmation. Jessica, as Senator Collins was the only Republican to vote against Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation, how could voting this way play out for her?
I think just the fact that we were talking about a Supreme Court seat is not the topic that Susan Collins wanted the final weeks of her election to be, because as you heard there, it really angered a lot of people with her vote to confirm Kavanaugh. And then I think that her vote against Barrett and her criticism of the process and of holding a vote so close to Election Day, it has the potential to sort of turn off conservative voters that she needs as well. But then I think that I'm not sure that she won a lot of plaudits for it from moderates and conservative Democrats that have long voted for her, because they just see they're not really fully trusting her necessarily. So I think Susan Collins, more than any senator this cycle, really shows how hard it is to be a sort of in the middle in this era of Trump. She's someone that is not a Trump type Republican, that has been sort of this pragmatic moderate centrist, but Trump forces you to sort of choose sides. And that's where she I think that vote for Kavanaugh, she could have had a primary challenge, for instance, was one, I think one big reason she was trying to protect her conservative flank, that the outgoing governor, a Trump acolyte there, Paul LePage, was even weighing a challenge against her. And so it's just hard to keep this sort of coalition together that she has built now for four terms across the spectrum, when people are really putting on their partisan jerseys and there's not a lot of people left in the middle. So Collins is the last New England Republican left in the Senate. And I think there's a pretty good chance we could be without any of those come January.
Where Browntown Gal writes on Twitter, Brownfield, Maine voter, I can't wait to vote Susan Collins out of office. Sarah Gideon will not be a Trump stand-in. And Anthony writes on Facebook, honestly, Collins could do the right thing every time and it won't matter. She still needs to lose. Mitch McConnell's leadership depends on how many Rs are beside the name of 51 senators. It's a dumb system, but it's what we have. So if you don't like Mitch, you can't vote for Collins. So how close would you say this race is at this point, Kevin?
You know, Sarah Gideon, the Democrat, has been ahead of Susan Collins in almost all the polls, you know, for months now. Her lead is varied from as high as 12 points to as low as 1 point. Most of them seem to be putting it in the 4 to 5 point range. But, you know, I think the expectation is that this is really going to be a close race. You know, Susan Collins she's kind of a political institution up here in Maine. She had approval ratings of, you know, close to 70% before 2016. And that's now cratered. But, you know, she's a formidable campaigner. So the most recent poll that just came out yesterday put Sarah Gideon up by 3, but that was within the margin of error. So I think there's a lot of, you know, the Democrats are confident, but they doesn't seem like they should be overconfident.
That's Kevin Miller, staff writer covering Maine state politics for the Portland Press-Herald. Kevin, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Jessica, Cecilia asks on Facebook, could your guest talk just a bit about Kentucky? Everyone thinks Mitch McConnell has this in the bag, and I am just not so sure. We voted all Democrat. Mitch McConnell left Kentucky and all of the American people high and dry via no second stimulus. Any thoughts there?
I think that when you look, though, at Kentucky, still a very conservative rural state. I mean, while we have seen tightening across the board in the presidential race, this is still a state that Trump won by 30 points. And while they did elect a Democratic governor last year in their off-year elections, Andy Beshear, it was against an incredibly unpopular Republican, Matt Bevin, that he ousted in races for Senate and for governor, of course, very different. And you know, Amy McGrath was sort of hailed as a very strong candidate, has a military background, talks about that. But I think she's been a pretty underwhelming candidate. She's raised a lot of money, I think, because again, Mitch McConnell is sort of this, you know, typifies everything that especially online liberal activists that are willing to donate money really hate about Washington and Republican control. But ultimately, listen, we have it rated in likely Republican. There's been a lot of money spent there. It has been one of the most expensive Senate races, but I just ultimately don't see it happening based on polling that I've seen, both public and private.
So election day is in five days. We know tens of millions of Americans have already cast their votes. I mean, what are you watching most closely in these days leading up to November 3rd?
I think we're waiting to see, you know, how are there fights over these ballots and how quickly those are counted? I mean, and then what turnout looks like on election day. We've seen, of course, very heavy turnout, but that is, you know, Democrats, we've seen in polling that they're the ones that are pushing to vote early, while Republicans, sort of pushed by the skepticism, really unfounded skepticism, to the frustration of many Republicans working on down ballot races that President Trump has tried to discredit, or, you know, mail-in voting and different things. I think that's a really risky strategy, and it's one that I know Republicans are very, you know, worried about, because if you wait until election day, what if there's bad weather, you get sick or something? It's just, do we see still high turnout on election day? What does it look like there? So, you know, we are reaching the end of early voting in many of these states and people sending back their ballots. And then, of course, it's going to be an election night like no other, because there's uncertainty with these ballots being counted, when we might know. And then, you know, just the fact that I think a lot of us are going to be watching this from home is very different.
Yeah, it's going to be a very late November 3rd. That was Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report. Jessica, it's always great to have you on.
Thank you, Jen.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.